I'm Tim Andrews. This session, Stress Testing and Capital Understanding the Tail, was going to be presented by Lucy Simpson and Rick Shaw. Unfortunately, Rick can't be here, and poor Lucy's pretty crook, but anyway, she's going to do her best to get through. Now, let me tell you a few things about Lucy. Probably not many of you know that Lucy's a tractor girl. Is anyone else here a tractor? You know what a tractor girl is? Any tractor boys? So tractor girls, that means that she supports Ipswich Town and the football club in the UK. And I think that's quite relevant to this topic because they're very much in the extremes. They actually won the premiership back in 1960-61, so they were at that end of the distribution that year. They've been at the relegation phase on several occasions, and I'm sure Lucy can remember the weekend when they lost 9-0 to Man United, which is still a record for the largest loss ever in a Premiership League game. Anyway, I think they're doing pretty well this year, aren't they? They're sixth or something, and they're okay. So they're looking to get up there. So as well as that, Lucy's got very relevant experiences to kind of talk to us about this today. Of course, she works at Deloitte, or not of course, but she does work at Deloitte. She's previously worked at Equitas in the UK, and that's all about running off companies and a kind of reinsurance environment, which is about the extremes. And she also does a lot of work now with banks and LMI in particular, and again, that's about managing the tail risk. So, yeah, please welcome Lucy.
Thank you, Tim. The talk this afternoon is divided into two parts. I'm going to start off with talking about economic capital modelling and some of the limitations around the generally accepted approach before I move on to discuss stress testing as an important and useful exercise, both in itself and as a complement to stochastic economic capital modelling. But I am going to start off with some apologies. As Tim mentioned, Rick was originally going to walk you through the first part of the presentation, and I was going to take over for the second part. Unfortunately, Rick's been unavoidably detained and is unable to join us. So my second apology is that I'm going to squeak and snuffle my way through the whole session. Hopefully I won't cough and sneeze too much. And then the third apology, just before we start, is I was looking at the title of this presentation. I did think it looked a bit dull. But in preparing to cover Rick's slides, I actually discovered an unintended pun, which you might pick up in a couple of slides' time. So, as I said, I'm going to kick off by talking a bit about stochastic modelling. And here I'm not making any apologies at all about the fact that I'm not going to go into a lot of deep technical detail, as that really, you'll see, is the way that I'm trying to frame this discussion. So I'm going to start with a quote from John Maynard Keynes, who described economic capital economic modelling as a contraption proceeding from premises which are not stated with precision to conclusions which have no clear application. Now, since Keynes said this, economic models used by financial services companies in particular have become much more intricate, arguably making his views even more pertinent. So when Rick and I started planning this session and the presentation, we started off by asking ourselves whether by making our models ever more complex and by adding more and more assumptions or layers of assumptions, are we actually improving the results and the outcomes of the work that we do? So we ended up essentially hypothesising that the philosophy that underpins stochastic modelling is wrong. Now, those of you that know Rick might have expected that in his part of the presentation there might be some controversial statements. So here we go. A typical stochastic modelling takes a whole heap of variables, models them either separately or by using relatively simple correlations, and then combines them to produce an answer. We actually believe that a more holistic approach using systems theorem or complexity theory, where the system is actually considered as a whole rather than as a series of individual components, is more appropriate, but recognising that this can be equally challenging to model. We know, for example, that the stochastic capital models of some banks contain literally thousands of independent variables, which are often estimated from scant data. Setting assumptions in these circumstances becomes a complex and time-consuming process, And it can actually inadvertently lead to introducing inconsistencies into your modelling. There's currently no way of effectively, with effectively being the key word here, no way of effectively modelling the relationships between independent variables, particularly when we're considering not just tens or hundreds, but possibly even thousands of variables. Correlation matrices are commonly used, but they describe linear relationships that primarily relate to one part of a distribution and not across a whole distribution. Typically, if they're working across the centre of our distribution, then they're not necessarily going to work for us in the tail, and in particular in the extreme tail. For example, if we consider what happened during the GFC, the US subprime portfolios were modelled using Gaussian copulas, which worked okay most of the time. But as the GFC showed, they didn't work in the tail of the distribution, where the relationships between the variables they were used to model were different to those that occurred in other parts of the distribution. And so maybe the paradigm of intricate stochastic modelling is the problem. And if it is, what do we do about it? Theoretically, stochastic modelling works at an atomic level. All electrons are the same. They follow defined rules. And in identical circumstances or conditions, they will all react in exactly the same way. But at a macro level, which is where we in financial services are generally working, this is not necessarily the case. There is no such thing as a truly independent variable in the systems that we typically try to model. And therefore, the concept of stochastic processes and independent variables doesn't necessarily really apply. So, as Holden and Madouris did, and just as an aside, if those of you that haven't read the paper, The Dog and the Frisbee, which was published in August 2012, it is a very good and very interesting paper. But as Holden and Madouris did in this paper, we're going to think about the formula which are required under Newtonian mechanics to describe the process of catching a frisbee. If you're going to do this, you have to allow for the size, the shape, the weight of the frisbee, the speed of its release and the rotation that it has. You need to consider the effects of gravity, wind speed, moisture in the air, and possibly a whole heap of other things, and then apply Newton's mechanical laws. I think we can agree that is a fairly complex exercise. Now, dogs are good at catching frisbees, and I'm fairly sure that they don't know much about Newtonian mechanics. So let's think about how they do it. Studies have shown that they do it by following a very simple rule of thumb, or that should probably be rule of paw if we're talking about dogs. And what actually happens is that the dog instinctively runs in a way that maintains approximately a constant angle of its eye to the frisbee. And that's how it actually manages to catch the frisbee. It is a big leap, not just for the dog that's catching the frisbee, but for us as well, to say that maybe it's worth considering that when systems are complex, simple heuristics actually work better than complex models. The dog here is operating on instinct and a simple rule. Maybe we should start to trust our own instincts more, the instincts that we've developed through years of professional experience, and actually do the same. In reducing complex relationships as to something that can fit easily into a model, we are in danger of losing a lot of the richness in our underlying data. What I have on this slide is a simple example to illustrate this point. Take a look at this graph and think about whether you can see any relationship between X and Y. This was part of a piece of admittedly unscientific work that Peter Swan of the University of Nottingham Business School did and detailed in a paper which coincidentally was also in August 2012. He did this unscientific survey of some of his colleagues, some of his students and some economists and said to them, can you see a relationship between X and Y? And broadly the results of this informal survey fell into three areas. The first was a lot of people were saying, no, there's no relationship here. The second one was saying, well, there probably is a relationship, but it's being obscured by the noise in the data. And the third camp that they fell into was saying the relationship really could be pretty much anything in this graph. So what I've done now is I've just added a few lines to the graph to show how some of the key, or to show some of the key relationships. And perhaps surprisingly, statistical analysis of this underlying data set of 400 or so points does actually show that there are some relationships. The green line on here gives us the least squares best fit, and the red lines show the 5 and 95% confidence intervals. So what we have here is a lot of varied data, as I said, more than 400 data points. And when we look at the best fit and we look at the confidence intervals, they do appear to be fairly closely related items of data. So what we're saying here really is, by taking a huge amount of data and squishing it down to just a few lines of information, we're losing so much. And this is what can happen in our complex stochastic capital models. We're not always sure whether applying the standard actuarial approaches is really distinguishing the signal from the noise, and we could be losing important messages from within our overall data set. So I've used the last few slides to highlight what we think is a significant issue, something that the profession as a whole needs to think about. And for the rest of this session, I'm going to move on to talk about stress tests and how they can be used to complement stochastic capital models. We found that even with an audience that's technically savvy, it can be difficult to articulate how a stochastic model works and to put things like modelling the results at a 99.5% probability of sufficiency into context. When your audience is non-actuarial, this problem can become even more difficult. We're also suggesting that complex stochastic modelling, as you've seen from the first part of the presentation, as a method of determining capital at, say, 99.5, may be a conceptually inappropriate framework. Having said that, we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. We're actually suggesting that we don't just rely on a single method, rather that we use other methods, such as stress testing, to validate and to sense-check the results of more complex modelling, and to help us to put the results into context and to articulate and explain them. As stated on this slide here, we see stress testing as a complement to the more sophisticated modelling techniques, not as a replacement. And for the remainder of this session, I'm just going to walk through a case study to illustrate the way in which we've used stress testing within Deloitte recently. To set the scene, I'll give you a brief overview of the problem we were seeking to address. As Tim mentioned earlier, I do a lot of work in the lender's mortgage insurance space, and in this instance, our client was an LMI provider in runoff. And they were seeking approval from APRA for a large release of capital. In order to achieve this, we need to demonstrate for them that even after the release, the company would be maintaining a solvency position in excess of the 99.5% probability of sufficiency, or to say that it would be in a position where it could withstand a 1 in 250 year event. For us, this was a long journey in uncharted territory, a journey that eventually took us over 4 years, a journey that, if successful, could potentially lead a nervous APRA to setting a precedent for capital releases for runoff companies. Initially, we developed a very complex stochastic model that was designed to estimate liabilities in the extreme tail and to enable us to actually calculate for these purposes the liabilities at a 99.5 probability of sufficiency. The model was run several times over the 4-year period, each time recalibrated and updated to use the latest portfolio information. And the results were presented to APRA in a variety of formats. They were discussed and they were presented in traditional actuarial style reports. Last year, however, we decided to take a slightly different approach. We applied multiple methods to estimate the 99.5 liabilities, and this involved developing three simple new approaches to complement and support our original stochastic modelling. This slide just simply illustrates the four methods that we applied. The four methods that we applied. They're numbered from 1 through to 4, from left to right, based on the level of complexity used in the underlying modelling. And you can see the most complex method over there on the right-hand side was a refreshed version of our original stochastic modelling. Now, for those of you that might have been at the biennial convention in 2010, and this is how long we've actually been using and developing this model, there was a presentation by Elaine Collins and Angela Tong around the development of that model, which went into a bit more technical detail. So it's effectively that model that we've been refreshing. But what this slide is actually trying to illustrate is that method two, our stress testing approach, our favourite approach, visually stands out from the others. This is the method that we think actually was the most easily articulated and presented the strongest argument to APRA when we had discussions with them. But more about that later. First, I'll just give you an overview of the other methods that we've used. Method one, which we called maintaining solvency, was used to draw a line in the sand. We looked at the financial position of the company 4 years earlier when the first application for the capital release was made. At this stage, the company hadn't been in runoff for very long. We looked at some portfolio statistics and some key ratios. Numbers of policies, exposure measures, solvency coverage ratios, etc. And then we looked at how they'd moved over the intervening 4 years. This clearly demonstrated that over time the solvency position of the company had been significantly strengthened. Capital levels had been maintained, while exposures had reduced, policies had seasoned, and liabilities had broadly run off in line with central estimates. So using this approach, we calculated the capital that would be required to support an equivalent solvency position to that which existed at the start of the process. And we used this simply as a simple benchmark for our other three methods. Method two, you can see, is our catastrophe event. It's our stress testing methodology, which I'm going to skip over for now, but I'll come back to in more detail on the next slide. Method three used a fairly simple credit risk default model. It used a few key assumptions to drive the results. It's basically run off probability of default, or PD, and loss given default, LGD, parameters, which are based on assumptions relating to the loan-to-value ratios of the properties at certain points in time, which gave us an idea of how much equity there was within any individual property. It used affordability measures and movements in house price indices, and in particular what we thought would happen to affordability and house price indices in the event of an economic downturn. In picking our assumptions, we had to create assumptions that were going to give us credible PDs and LGDs for a 1 in 250-year return period. While there are not many assumptions in this modelling, and they are applied in a fairly simple way, it wasn't a simple task to actually select their values. What does a 1 in 250-year economic downturn look like? This is where experience came into play. And we selected what we believed were reasonable assumptions. We compared them with global experience, given that historically the Australian economy hasn't really suffered the sort of downturns that we were trying to model here. We then ran the model to produce the results, indicating a level of capital that would be required to withstand what we thought was the 1 in 250-year event. Fairly simple model, but running off some of the same parameters as our more sophisticated stochastic model, which we've got as method four. This model considers the relationships between the key drivers of loss, namely house prices, unemployment rates, and interest rates. And as we said earlier, when we were talking more generically about some stochastic capital modelling, we did assume some correlation between those different parameters. We ran thousands of iterations of the complex model, applying each scenario to every policy in the portfolio to assess the potential losses. We ranked our, I think it was around 50,000 scenarios by size of the aggregate loss, as you typically do with these models, and we simply took the 49,750th largest, which equated to our 99.5, and therefore gave us the required level of capital. We looked in a lot of detail at this scenario. We produced time series graphs for the key economic assumptions. So we looked over a 30-year time horizon at what our model was telling us was happening to the interest rate environment, to unemployment rate, and to house price indices. We considered again whether these were reasonable scenarios by comparing them to the economic conditions in other countries where we have seen significant downturns and losses in the housing market. So as with Method 3, we were applying some judgment regarding the reasonableness of our results. Now I'm going to go back and talk in a little bit more detail about the stress testing approach. As I said, this is intuitively the most simple to understand, particularly in light of the return period concept. So we're likening this approach to the dog and the frisbee. This is using our intuition and our experience to come up with a fairly simple solution. We wanted to stress the portfolio by considering a couple of catastrophe events that would have a huge impact on this portfolio of policies. Given that this is a lender's mortgage insurance portfolio, we needed to think about events that would either cause significant drops in property values or large numbers of defaults, or possibly both. But we also wanted something that was visual and that people would understand. So we didn't want to just talk about a high unemployment rate or a drop in the house price indices. We wanted something that people could relate to. So we came up with two scenarios. The first indicated here, which was a meteorite strike on a highly populated area within Australia. And the second was looking at an epidemic or a pandemic. And perhaps if we were doing this work today, we'd be talking about an Ebola outbreak or something similar. But before we did any modelling, we wanted to challenge ourselves to think about whether these events were really what we needed. Now, if we think about a 20% unemployment rate, we ask ourselves, is that a 1 in 50-year event? Is it a 1 in 100-year event? Is it a 1 in 200-year event? It is quite a difficult question, even for those of us that work in this space, to answer. But then we said to ourselves, is a meteorite hitting a major city in Australia a 1 in 250-year event? And of course we said, yeah, of course it is. You know, it was easy to conceptualise what that meant in terms of how often it might happen. So this suggested we were on the right track with these type of scenarios. So we started our modelling. And as you recall, this, as I said, was one of the more simple techniques that we used. We thought about where a meteorite strike would have the greatest impact. And obviously this would be where the greatest concentration of properties and policyholders lay. So we used postcode level data to assess exposure against all the main residential areas in Australia, which was the capital cities. And we assessed the exposure in each so that we could model the potential losses. The next question we considered was how much damage would there be? Well, as it says on the slide, the largest ever recorded meteorite strike caused damage across approximately a 20-kilometre radius. So we assumed that our strike would have a similar radius. We then needed to think about what was actually going to happen within that radius. And we made some fairly simple assumptions. And in this description, I am oversimplifying it, but we looked at the PD and the LGD. And effectively, we assumed that the people that own properties within that perimeter would all default on their loans. So we were assuming a probability of default of 100%. And then we had to make an assumption around how much the loss would be if everybody had defaulted. So we took a 75%, I think it was, LGD assumption. Now, this was based on the fact that at the centre of this impact, we think all the properties would have been destroyed, and probably not just the properties, but the land that they sat on as well. But as we got out towards the perimeter, we would have still some potentially residual land value, even if the properties were completely destroyed. So once we'd got our PD and our LGD, and we knew what our exposure was in various areas as we'd segmented the country, we were able to calculate the potential loss for each of these areas, which, as I said, is a very simple calculation. And as expected, given that this portfolio had a concentration of risk in Queensland, the largest loss was going to occur if the meteorite hit somewhere close to the centre of Brisbane. We applied a similar type of logic, but using slightly differently formulated PD and LGD assumptions for the pandemic scenario. And at this point, we'd got results from four different approaches, so we thought we'd compare them, because we had done all this modelling independently. And we actually found that they stacked up very well. We had a difference of approximately 8.5% across the four different methods. So this left us at the end of a process, ready to enter into discussions with our clients and APRA. And this time, there was a very different feel and focus to the discussions. The dialogue that we had was much more open and useful than when we had previously gone with simply a stochastic model that looked at the tail results. Much of the discussion that we actually had centred around the stress testing results. It centred around the simple scenarios where we could actually look and say what this scenario meant in terms of PD and LGD across the area that was impacted, but also across the whole portfolio as well. As I said, the discussion centred around the stress testing results. They were easier to articulate. They were actually easier for APRA to challenge. They had more questions around those. But it was also easier for us to respond to those questions and challenges and have a useful discussion. So in this particular case study, while stress testing and the other methods that we used didn't replace the complex modelling, they certainly did support it, and they really opened up the conversations which we had, leading to us being in a position of helping our client achieve the desired outcomes. So in closing the presentation, I just want to touch briefly on the theme of the conference, which was Ensuring Tomorrow, and how actuaries can contribute to the changing economic, social and regulatory landscape. Now, Rick and I believe that the profession can add the most value, not necessarily through producing ever more complex solutions to the problems that we face, but by applying our experience and our judgment to turn difficult and complex issues into things that can be easily communicated and understood. So I'd just like to thank you for attending the session. I'm happy to take any questions now, although I might point you in Rick's direction for anything relating to his area of expertise.
Well done, Lucy. We would hardly have known you were a crook. Questions?
Daniel Keating, Genworth. As I took the last bit of that presentation, you were kind of talking through a process where you selected a 1 in 250-year event and used the analogy of a meteor strike to describe that. So what did you find were the advantages of choosing a meteor strike as opposed to trying to describe an economic scenario? What were the things that really helped you in dealing with APRA?
It was interesting. I think, and again, this is a very simple answer, but I think one of the things about that is it's just simply an engaging idea. It opened up discussion. Ultimately, it led us on to a conversation around whether that would happen, what the impact on the portfolio would be, which really took us through to talking about PDs and LGDs. But it was really just an engaging scenario, and it gave us some great pictures to put in our reports. Having said that, I mean, obviously from an LMI perspective, we did acknowledge that perhaps is not a realistic scenario. We do know that a lot of LMI portfolios have reinstatement clauses in them, for example, which means that it's perhaps not a completely realistic scenario. But we just found it a useful tool to open up the dialogue and to start to think about what the impact of major events could potentially be.
Any other question? I might just ask one. You may know that APRA is requiring financial institutions to do some stress testing work at the moment using some pretty... I won't comment on the assumptions, except to say that there's it involves, say, property price falls of 40%, unemployment rates of the order of 12 or 14, I think, and so interest rate rises as well. Is that helpful?
I think it has been helpful. I was a little bit surprised about how some of it's been reported in the press over the last couple of weeks, the results of the test, and there's been some sort of fairly striking headlines. From our perspective, our particular client is in runoff and wasn't required to do that stress testing. However, this is actually something that Rick and I are working on at the moment. We think there is value in it, and it's something that we're doing for our client. We're looking at what the APRA stress test implies, and we're almost starting to consider that as a fifth method in revisiting some of these calculations and some of our modelling. So, yeah, I think we think that there is some value in it, and we're looking at it from our client's perspective, even though they're not actually required to do that work.
Any other questions?
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thanks, Lucy. Please join me in appreciating Lucy for a great presentation.